Our guest this month on Via GARS is Dr. David Rimlin, the Chief of Infectious Diseases at the Atlanta VA Medical Center. Dr. Rimlin is also specialized in the research and the treatment of HIV. Dr. Rimlin, tell us about your time at the Atlanta VA Medical Center and your work with HIV.
I've actually been at the VA for quite a long period of time, saw our first patient with HIV in 1982. And since that time, we've actually seen over 4,200 patients here at the VA. We follow about 1,600, which is actually the largest workload of any VA in the country in terms of the number of patients with HIV. And over the years, obviously, we've dealt with very serious problems. Unfortunately, about now 15 years ago, we had good drugs that were introduced. Patients have been doing much better. And now we're really dealing with a much more chronic disease and some of the complications that are related to it.
What progress have you seen in the treatment of veterans who are HIV positive?
It's actually been very dramatic. As I said, about 1996 is when we had the potent drugs, which have been variously called the highly active antiretroviral drugs. And when that happened, several things really were quite obvious. One is that the mortality in terms of the patients that we were seeing went down dramatically. Used to be, before that period of time, that almost 25% of the people we would see in a particular year would die that year of their HIV disease. Really quite remarkable. Since that time, we're down now to a mortality rate of about 1%, which is about the same as it is for veterans that are HIV negative. So that the overall death rate is just really remarkable how much it went down. Associated with that is the number of hospitalizations we've seen, and patients obviously are doing clinically much better. What has really developed now, and the reason we've been very interested in the what has followed afterwards, is that patients now really don't have HIV as their main problem. They're getting older now, and now they're dealing with a lot of diseases that we would associate with aging, like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, cancers. And our interest is to look at those particular comorbidities, we call them, and see how much of that is really associated with HIV. There's growing evidence that HIV must do something a little bit more than just have a patient that is getting older. And it's actually because of inflammation or other issues that they are really developing some of these complicating comorbid conditions.
Are more veterans asking for an HIV test?
This has actually been a very interesting development in the VA. Before 2009, we were kind of stuck with a federal law that we had to do written informed consent with pre-test and post-test counseling. And it was very hard to get the doctors in the primary care clinics to spend 15 minutes trying to do that when they had a limited amount of time to see patients. So it was very difficult to get testing done other than in people that were apparently at high risk or already had things that looked like they may have AIDS. In 2009, the federal law was actually repealed, and now all we have to do is get a verbal consent, which can be very brief, documented in the record. And since that time, we've gone from testing about 1,000 patients a year here at the Atlanta VA to now testing almost 20,000 a year. So we do a lot of testing. And what the VA has suggested in their guidelines is that every veteran ought to be tested at least once, regardless of age, regardless of any risk factors. And we are getting close to that. On our last evaluation for last year's patients that we're seeing here, almost 60% had already been tested for HIV. So I think we're really doing a great job once we got away from having to do the written informed consent.
So it's been easier for veterans to get an HIV test.
Exactly, and this really has made a huge difference. And it's something that the CDC has really been recommending since about 2006, but has been limited really by a lot of things, including some state laws, including Georgia, that still requires a written informed consent. So that we're hoping that testing for HIV will really become much more routine and part of what is part of medical care in general, and we'll get more people tested. That's a very important issue. One of the things we've shown when we increased our testing is that we are now diagnosing people much earlier in the course of their HIV disease. The CD4 count, which is a measure of their immune system, is a good marker in terms of how long people have been infected, how much they're immunocompromised. And as we've been testing more and more, the CD4 count at the time of diagnosis continues to go up, indicating that we're obviously testing people much earlier in the course of the disease when we have a much better chance of preventing the complications, being able to treat them with the current drugs that we have, which are really very effective and very well tolerated.
Dr. Rimland, could you tell us the difference between HIV and AIDS?
Okay, it's a little bit of a semantic issue. HIV infection simply means that we know that you've been infected with HIV and can find the virus in your blood in most situations. A few people may not have virus detected and they're able to control it, but the majority of people will have the virus in their blood. We know they've been infected with HIV. An AIDS diagnosis, at least before 1993, meant that you, in addition to having HIV infection, had one of 23 different what we call opportunistic infections or tumors. And these were infections or tumors that usually were associated with other immunosuppressed patients that were on chemotherapy for cancer or other situations. And by definition, again, before 1993, if you had one of these tumors or infections, then you had AIDS. Now, when we started developing drugs that could actually prevent some of these infections, we still had people that were just as immunosuppressed. Their CD4 count was low. So that in 1993, the CDC changed the definition and now included people that had CD4 counts of less than 200 and would also call them AIDS. So that's really the difference. It's a little bit of a semantic issue about whether you have an infection or not. But since we're able to prevent some of these infections, it's really much more common nowadays to really just say that somebody has HIV infection and then look at their CD4 counts so that we know what level of immunosuppression they have currently.
Is it true that someone can only get HIV by person-to-person contact with someone who is already infected?
That's the only way. The really things have not changed in terms of what we know about transmission. We know that sexual transmission, both homosexual and heterosexual transmission, is very important. We know that things like sharing needles is very important and how IV drug users became infected. And certainly in places that don't have effective drugs that are available, mother to newborn transmission still can occur. Although in the United States, that's actually become very uncommon because of the ability to diagnose these women early, give them medications, and therefore their children don't become infected. But the transmission modes in terms of sexual transmission, IV drug use, have not really changed. The thing has changed a little bit. It used to be a problem before we had testing of the blood available was blood transfusions. And that, once we had the HIV test available in 1985, that no longer was an issue. Unfortunately, before that period of time, people that got a lot of blood transfusions, such as hemophiliacs, were infected. And this was a tragic story before we had HIV testing available that they were getting infected from contaminated blood. But that, as I said, has not been an issue since 85.
You also treat other infectious diseases, and that must keep you busy as well.
It does, and obviously, although HIV is what keeps me busy in terms of a lot of our outpatient work, we're obviously also in charge of other infectious diseases. On an inpatient basis, we consult on anybody who has infections dealing from pneumonia to bloodstream infections to a variety of other things. We obviously have to deal with transmission of infection in hospitals. We have to get involved, for example, with the Ebola scare to start planning in terms of what we would do with Ebola, training people about Ebola, so that we get involved in a lot of things that are going on. Seems to be something new almost every other week in terms of infections that we deal with, which for me has been exciting because it's intellectually very stimulating, obviously.
What information do you have about Ebola?
It's actually, there's a lot of sources of information, as you know, fortunately with CDC being here, with a number of infectious disease colleagues that are actually taking care of these patients at Emory. We hear a lot about it. We've had courses. We've had lectures. We get a lot of information. The VA has also been very proactive in terms of training exercises, getting information out, and really now trying to identify specific VAs around the country that will actually be caring for patients that are infected. And this is an ongoing issue. It's, in some ways, obviously, it's very important for us to be prepared. On the other hand, I think it's very important to not get too overexcited about the situation. It's still a limited number of patients that have Ebola that have come into the United States. Now that we recognize what needs to be done in terms of limiting transmission, using personal protective equipment, I think hopefully this will really limit what happened in Dallas in terms of the two healthcare workers that are being, became infected. And as the epidemic slows down slowly in West Africa, hopefully there will be less and less people that potentially get infected and then have to be brought to the United States for their care. So, yes, it's something we have to be aware of and prepared for. It's no different than what we had to do and concern a number of years ago with the anthrax scare. And again, we had to do training. We had to tell people what to do. When there was concern about smallpox, we had to deal with that. So there always seems to be something, and I think simply indicates that as a medical entity, we have to be prepared for unusual situations, know what needs to be done, know what needs to be done in terms of isolating the patient and then providing them appropriate care.
How important is it for veterans to take part in your programs?
I think it's critically important. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we've tried very hard to test every veteran to discover who's positive. Obviously, you can't treat them until you know they're positive. It's also important because the people that don't know they're infected are continuing to spread the virus around and transmission continue occur. We know that getting into care makes a huge difference in terms of the person's own health, but also limiting transmission to others, so that it really is a very critical issue. We're really very fortunate within the VA system because if people are eligible for VA care, they've had service in the military and had an honorable discharge, they are eligible for care. And even if they are below the poverty level, there essentially is no payment that they have in terms of their care. If they're above the poverty level, depending on how high it is, at most they'll have a copay for their visit to the clinic, and then have really a minimal payment for the medications that can become very, very expensive. So that, in many ways, being a veteran is really a huge advantage if you happen to be HIV positive and can make it into a system where you don't have to worry about where you get your drugs, where you get your testing. Obviously, care at the VA, we think, is excellent. We compare to many other settings where this has been looked at, and the VA is now as good or better than many other settings in terms of providing medical care. A lot of it having to do with the introduction of the electronic medical record in 1999, and being able to see everything in the computer, being able to get information from veterans that have gone to other VAs. I sit at my computer and I see everything that's happened there. I can look at their x-rays, see their notes, see what medications they're on. That's a huge advantage that really is something that ought to be a model in terms of how medical care is provided in this country in general.
How do veterans get into your research projects?
Really just being at the VA and being in our patients. Obviously, there are some studies that we do that require informed consent because they are true research protocols, and we have to get consent from the patient to get information, to give them particular drugs, to do particular tests. There are other studies that we do that are called cohort studies that allow us, through an IRB approval process, to actually collect information without direct consent, because all we're doing is collecting aggregate data. No specific patient information, so that, you know, depending on the type of study that we are doing, it's very easy, and our patients are really very used to doing these research protocols. We have a number of them that have been going on really for almost 30 years right now, so they are very anxious to really get involved, both for getting information about themselves and really for the ability to hopefully help other people in the future. But we have an enthusiastic group of people that are here. They know they're getting good care and are really, for the most part, very anxious to help us out with some of these research studies that we're involved with.
Any final thoughts?
Appreciate letting everybody know about the VA. I think it's sometimes underappreciated, and sometimes people don't understand the amount of HIV care that we provide. It is the largest, as I said, VA in the country in terms of HIV workload, and really reflecting what is happening in the Southeast. And I think that's important for people to understand that the epicenter, really, of the HIV epidemic really is now in the Southeast, especially minorities, younger minorities, and in gay men. And I think we see all of them here, and obviously reflects the types of patients that we see at our VA, reflecting pretty much what's happening in the Atlanta area in terms of HIV disease.
We would like to thank Dr. David Rimlin, Chief of Infectious Diseases at the Atlanta VA Medical Center, for being our guest this month on ViaGARS. The Atlanta Rehabilitation Research and Development Center of Excellence for Visual and Neurocognitive Rehabilitation, CVNR, and the Atlanta Office of the Birmingham Atlanta VA Geriatric Research, Education, and Clinical Center, GREC, proudly partner with GARS to reach veterans and their loved ones with information about research and services at the Atlanta VA Medical Center through this monthly broadcast, Veterans Information at GARS. The CVNR's mission is to foster the health and well-being of veterans through uniquely synergistic research impacting visual and our neurocognitive function. The mission of GREC is to improve VA healthcare delivery to effectively meet the medical, psychological, and the social needs of older veterans through research, education, and clinical services with a special focus on mobility, palliative care, and incontinence.